My name is Jennifer Krong from the Assist Learning Podcast. I'm a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual hosts. Make sure you check out all the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com and get ready because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Ernest Dempsey is a USA Today best-selling author of the thrilling Sean Wyatt series. He is a former school counselor and a soccer coach. You're going to love this talk. By the way, if you're listening the week of May 14th, 2018, Amazon is giving away his first book, The Secret of the Stones, for Kindle. That's right. They're giving it away for free. You'll like it. Fast-paced, thrilling. Check it out.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
Ernest Dempsey is a USA Today best-selling author from Chattanooga, Tennessee. His Sean Wyatt archaeological thriller series has been downloaded over 500,000 times across the globe. Dempsey attended Southern Adventist University near Chattanooga and earned a degree in psychology plus a master's degree in counseling. He published his first novel in 2010 with The Secret of the Stones. The sequel came in 2011 and propelled him toward a career in writing. In 2015, Ernest quit his day job after 12 years as a high school guidance counselor and began writing full time. His fiction is best known for its meticulous research, in-depth history, and furious pacing. All of those factors contribute to stories that are nearly impossible to put down. And I got to tell you, you don't want to put them down, all right? His latest, The Templar Curse, is the 15th installment in the Sean Wyatt series. Please welcome Ernest Dempsey to the show. Say hi to everyone, Ernie.
Hi, everyone.
Ernie, I'm so glad you're here with me. You know, back in the fall, I happened to catch you on another podcast, Mark Dawson's self-publishing podcast, and I had to reach out to you because I hope he'll talk with me. And next thing I know, here you are, and I so greatly appreciate it.
I will talk all day with you. That's the problem. Like, the problem isn't whether I'll talk with you; it's whether I'll shut up.
Well, we both have a problem then, because I'll do the same thing. So you better be watching the time. But thank you so much for joining me. And what I'd like to do before we start talking about you and your writing career, you worked as a school counselor and even coached soccer before. What do you like best about working in a school and with kids?
Well, the answer is inside of that question. I liked working with the kids. That was the best part of it. Getting every year I would have, you know, as a counselor, you'd have hundreds of kids on your caseload and you know, you don't get to know all of them necessarily, but the ones you do get to know, the ones that come by pretty regularly and just talk with you and are just they're a little different than everybody else. They kind of stand out from the crowd. Those kids I'm still friends with today. Like, just the relationships that you develop, you know, with them as they're growing into adulthood and, you know, staying in contact with them, you know, thanks to social media and stuff now. It's so cool to see them, you know, growing into their lives. That's one thing I miss about it. You see them come in as freshmen, like these little babies, and then, 8 years later, they're out of college and, you know, working and doing stuff. And I miss seeing that development. But the biggest thing that I really miss about all of it was, some of the teachers are really cool to work with. I miss, you know, being a writer, you're kind of on an island and, you have a network of other authors you talk to and chat with. And I'm very fortunate. I've got a lot of good new friends, you know, in the author community now that are really nice people. But, the teachers were nice and the camaraderie was nice with them. But the best part for me was coaching the soccer. I coached girls. I was an assistant coach for the girls team at Dalton High School for 3 years. And then I started the boys program at Morris Innovative High School and ran that for 4 years. And I really miss, it's funny to say it, but like, I miss being on the road trips with the guys and those uncomfortable school bus seats and you know, just the laughing and the joking around with them. And my kids were all free reduced lunch. They were all, you know, Title I school kids. And so they were very real. And I could cut up with them as much as I wanted to. And they would do the same with me. And it was that part I really missed, those, especially those boys. And I loved my girls too. But the boys were my boys. And I was the head coach and I started that program. And I'm still friends with most of them to this day. And it was that part I really miss, because it was like I had all these sons, you know. And even though they were all Hispanic mostly, like my school was I think it was 65-70% Hispanic population at Morris. So most of them were either Mexican or Guatemalan descent. And so it was nice. It was really a cool thing to have that little cultural element in my life as well. So I miss that too. But yeah, I love those kids. I still chat with them on Facebook and stuff like that. Ask them if they saw the you know, El Clasico, you know, in Spain, or, you know, they're becoming big United fans now in MLS. So yeah, that was the thing I missed the most is the coaching. So
that's very cool. That's having been a soccer coach myself, and then watched my kids go through soccer and play and working with kids. And it's funny, because as a principal, one of the things I looked for was to try, because I coached goalies when I was a teacher, but when I became principal, I never realized that having been a coach and stuff like this might pay off for me, because mm-hmm. I went to schools to make change. And in when I went to this one school, and I used it in a couple of schools then after this, but I was looking for a way for the kids to get to know me. And one of the ways, I used to play in band and I play trumpet and stuff like this. And so one of the ways
Me too.
Oh, very cool. Well, very nice. And so one of the things I would do is I would pull out my trumpet and I'd go to the band director and say, you know, can you let me sit in? And so that would lead to me playing in the stands during football season. And, mm-hmm. And so that was one way, and the kids would get to know me. And I started looking for another way. And another way was, and by the way, that's a blast when you do that, because they let you revert to 16. And so you're up there doing this dancing and all that sort of stuff. And,
oh yeah.
And it, you gotta like that. Of course, it's bad when you're the one talking and the band director's looking to see who in the trumpet section keeps talking.
You and I have the same malady. I feel like you got in trouble in school for talking too much in the back, and I have the same problem.
Yeah, that would be my thing. And, you know, it's one of those things. And we had, and then so it came to me, I'm like, well, what about doing little pickup soccer games and stuff like this? And so the first time I tried it, one kid showed up. And he's kicking the ball back and forth with me. He said, would you like more kids here? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. The next time we had about 60. And then that was something that went on with me. And I even took it to another school. And those kids, it was really fun, because now, you know, there's nothing like being in the age bracket I was and am now. And, you know, you get out there and you're like, all right, guys, I'm going to make it. And you can't show that you're tired or worn out. So you just got to push through, right? Because that way they see you there. And it's just funny, because the more you played with them, the more they'd start. We'd do these pickup games. And so we'd have enough kids where they'd put together multiple teams. And the first one to score a goal, the other team would be able to continue on. And that team would be eliminated until your next try again. And so what started happening was they'd actually pass me the ball. And give me a chance to score and stuff like that. So that got to be fun. But it was I miss those days a lot. That was a lot of fun. So I understand what you mean. In my world now, I love being able to do what I do, but at the same time, what I miss the most is those types of interactions with the kids. Cool stuff. So tell me, what do you think is one of the most challenging aspects of working with kids in schools today?
So I looked at this question ahead of time. And my first answer to that question is with a question: how much time you got? Because that's a loaded question, I'll try not to get on my soapbox about that, because I've got a lot of very strong opinions when it comes to education, and they may be right or wrong, I don't know, but I think that the most challenging aspect of working with kids in schools today is meeting them where they are. And that's a very vague statement, so I'll elaborate. What I saw when I was still in the system a few years ago was a struggle going on between most teachers, not all, but most teachers in our system in both schools, because we had two high schools in Dalton Public School System. The struggle was fighting against the technology that was in the kids' hands. So, you know, turn your phones off, put your phones away, do this, whatever. And it was the teachers were trying to wrestle control back from the kids and so that they could force learning on them. And that's right there is sort of the problem in education in general, not just public, but private as well, because they have the same model essentially. Is that you're forcing this information on kids who don't necessarily want it in that way. It doesn't mean that they don't want to learn. It's just that the way that you're trying to get them to learn it or what you're trying to get them to learn, they may not be interested in. And that's really hard because, you know, the whole setup for public schools is, and private too, is a shotgun approach to try to educate the most you can in the most efficient amount of time possible. And I come from a school of thought with, you know, Dr. Howard Gardner's multiple intelligence theory, where, you know, if he had his druthers, all the schools would be set up based on either the kids, you know, passionate interests or their, you know, their skill sets that they're, you know, that they identify most with or whatever. But I think that, you know, with what we have and what we have in place, it's not going away anytime soon. And so what we have to do is work to improve it. And I think that the biggest problem is that it, like I said, meeting the kids where they are. Well, okay, this is what they're interested in. This is what they're talking about. This is what they want to do or what they're pulled to. And so instead of trying to pull them away from that, how can we figure out a way to join them where they are? So a perfect example of this was, you know, I didn't do a whole lot of classroom instruction. I did do health classes when it came to like the anti-drug talks and some of the bullying stuff and things like that. But I was giving a test one day, and it was the PARC test or whatever that
yes.
that came out with a few years ago, and it was the first time we were doing it. We were one of the pilot schools to do it. And I told all the kids in the classroom, okay, here, this is a very short test. You're going to read a passage, and at the end of the passage, you're going to answer like four or five questions, and they're short answer. They're not multiple choice. So you need to have, you know, read the passage, and all these kids, this is before the test even begins. They've still got their phones. Some of them are like looking at their iPads because our school had iPads. And they're scrolling through their Facebook news feeds, and they're doing all whatever on Instagram, and this one kid looks up at me and he goes, "Mr. D, I don't read." And I said, "You don't read?" And he goes, "No." And I said, "What's that on your phone there?" Because I had already seen it because I was walking around and I was about to take up the phones and whatever and the digital devices. And he said, "Oh, it's nothing." And I said, "Oh, it looks like you were looking through your Facebook feed." And he goes, "Well, yeah." And I said, "So you were reading through your news feed?" And he goes, "Yeah." And all the other kids start laughing, right? They're all cracking up because they see my point. And I said, "See, you do read. You just, it's what you want to read. It's what you're interested in. So the problem isn't reading. It's your interest in what you're choosing to read." And so, to that point, and that's a simplified answer to it, but to the point I was making is sticking with the reading thing. Kids read, right? They read. And it just depends on the context. Like, how can we get them to read the classics? How can we get them to read, you know, these assignments and and answer these things and think provocatively about, you know, what they're reading and dig deeper. You know, kids, I used to get teachers all the time would come in and say, at both schools, they would say, oh, so-and-so, you need to talk to this kid. He's not going to do his work. Well, first of all, that's hilarious that I have that magic wand that makes kids, as a counselor, everybody knows this, that we have a magic wand that makes kids do their work.
Exactly.
But I, you know, I always wanted to say, why don't you give them work that they want to do? Now that's easy and that's a burden on teachers. I get that. That's hard. But at the same time, you know, I would get teachers that would tell me that. And I said, well, what kind of work are you doing? Well, we do all these handouts and everything. And so one of my buddies that works for the Buck Institute, he and I gave we had a faculty meeting one day and it was a pure psychological experiment. There was a purpose to it too, but we gave them SMART goals and we handed out sheets of like 8 or 9 pages to every teacher in the building. And we said, and this is so funny. This is what cracks me up about teachers because they're still just kids, right? and I mean this in not an insulting way because they're people, they were kids. So they still are. They're just older now, but they would file in, we'd hand them out and we'd tell everybody before they're coming in. Now, don't ask any questions until everybody has your sheets, and then we'll tell you what you're supposed to do. Always, always, every time we did something like this, they'd start asking questions. Like they would completely disregard the information, the instructions we just gave them, which is funny because they used to complain that kids would do that. And then the same, and then we'd give them all these sheets this one time, and we said, "No, we need you guys to fill all this stuff out before you leave today." And they're like flipping through it. They look so annoyed. There's scowls on faces across the room. And all of them to a person would say, "Man, this looks like a lot of paperwork." And that's when we stopped them and said, "Exactly. You complain about the kids not doing their work, these handouts that you give them, and you guys won't, nobody likes doing paperwork. Like nobody likes doing stuff that's just mundane and it's not instruction, you know, it's just maybe paperwork works for some kids. It does. And it's an efficient way to do it for some kids, but other kids need to be taught differently. And that is the most challenging aspect, I think, of working with kids is how can you meet them where they are? And I'm not saying that they need to be coddled or that everything needs to be bent around every single individual kid in the planet, but there's got to be some sort of middle ground where they can be met. And, you know, I don't know if that's project-based learning. I don't know if it's something else that's out there, but kids want to create. Okay. They want to do stuff. Now, sometimes, you know, there's kids that just want to play video games or whatever. And I get that, but I bet later on down the road, that kid would enjoy, you know, creating video games or perhaps writing the stories that go into video games or just the art. Like the kids that I worked with, some of the worst students in the world, as far as, you know, math and science, were brilliant with cars. They got a new car when I was working in the school system, and they popped open the hood and wanted to look at it and do all this stuff. They were telling me all these details about what I should do to it. And I mean, just boom, boom, boom. And I had one kid that had an ankle bracelet on, and you know, he'd been in juvenile detention. And, I asked him, I said, how come you got that jewelry on your leg? And he said, I got caught. And I said, well, no, I mean, obviously you got caught, but I mean, what happened? What was the crime that you committed? And he said, I was stealing other kids' bicycles. Hmm. And I didn't really dive into the whole, thing about, you know, well, why that's wrong. And, you know, how would you feel if somebody stole something from you and all that? Because at this point in their development, it's almost, I don't want to say it's too late to hit home on that, but it's not too late to hit home on something else. And I said, so what do you do with these bicycles when you steal them or other stuff that you steal? What do you do? Do you sell it? And he goes, yeah, I sell it. I find somebody, you know, I find people that buy it. And I said, you know what, man, you don't sound like a criminal to me. You sound like an entrepreneur. You're just acquiring products the wrong way. I said, you know, that there's a whole world full of products out there that you can acquire for a very reasonable amount of money and mark those products up and sell them to the public legally. And you don't have to worry about looking over your shoulder to see if the cops are chasing you. You never have to wear that ankle bracelet again. So in fact, there's a whole country across the other side of the planet called China that's got warehouses full of stuff that they can't sell that you probably could. And it's like, China? I said, yeah, but you've ever heard of an airplane? They'll ship it here. Like, they're trying to get rid of it. Kid's mind was blown. But that's my point, is the challenge is meeting them where they are. And that's really hard when you've got 30 kids in a classroom, and you've got, you know, four or five preps during a day, and you've got, you know, 150 kids that you're going to see. It's hard to meet 150 kids where they are. That's the challenge. And I don't know how teachers are going to do it, and I don't have all the answers, but, anyway, there's the 20-minute answer to the, loaded question that you had. And thanks everybody for joining us on the podcast today. That's all the time we have.
No, he's fooling. We got lots of time left. So okay. I love your
answer. I didn't know how long this was going to be, so I was. I'm sorry if I talked too much.
Oh, you're fine. You're fine. We've got time. And
but does that answer okay?
That answer is awesome, because that's that is one of the major challenges. I mean, because you've got all kinds of kids. I mean, it's whatever their background is. So like, I was one of the schools, and I was telling you that soccer story. One of the schools where I was playing soccer with the kids was had a very large Hispanic population from primarily from different areas of Mexico and other Central American countries, but the as well as African nations and so forth. We had a lot of different nationalities, but I learned something very valuable about the Hispanic, especially those kids who were from Mexico, because they would teach. Most adults would think that they talked to each other in Spanish and they understood each other in Spanish. And you would experience stuff when you're playing on the field where they didn't understand the Spanish each other was speaking.
And yeah.
That itself was something that it was very eye-opening, because when you talk about meeting them where they are, they can fool people into thinking that they really understand, the differences between the conversational language and the academic language. If they're not getting the conversational, they're definitely not getting the academic. And, it's just kind of funny when you experience that. And the one kid says, would you speak English? I don't know what you're talking about. And you'd experience that from time to time. But yeah, right up your alley. Well, because even though, and one of the things when you talk with teachers about looking at all the kids you have, because they don't have to be from another country. They don't have to be from, from a dysfunctional family. All kids are at different levels, and you've hit a very valuable lesson on, that nail on the head right there. Awesome answer. So, well, let's shift from talking about school and working with kids, and let's talk about your writing. Where did that desire to write come from? Did you always want to be a writer? And when did you start wanting to write, and what was your inspiration?
Back when I was in, I guess, seventh or eighth grade, I started reading some fantasy stuff, some like dragons and things like that. But so when I started writing little snippets of beginnings of stories that I never finished in like, ninth grade or whatever, a lot of them had to do with knights and dragons and stuff like that. Medieval stuff was really cool to me. But honestly, where the real storytelling truly began was when I was actually much younger than that. I was probably 6 or 7 years old, and maybe eight. And, I was a huge fan of Scooby-Doo, and I was a huge fan of the movie The Goonies.
Nice. I like both of those. Awesome.
Yeah, and I loved Indiana Jones.
Ooh.
And I was fascinated by treasure hunting. Like I had books. My grandpa, my mother's dad, had a book about lost outlaw treasures in the United States, and places where, like, these clues that had been left about where these people buried treasures in the United States. And then there was the pirate thing and all that stuff. And I was so fascinated by that. And I'll never forget this moment. But this is where my storytelling journey began. I took the inspiration from the Goonies and Indiana Jones, and I took a piece of paper, and you know, and it was a notebook paper, so it had the blue lines across it, which is ridiculous. But I drew out a treasure map on it, and then I took like a lighter or some matches or something, which, good job on my parents. I guess back in the 80s, it was a little different. Like, you could just play with whatever you wanted, run around the neighborhood, no big deal.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but I burned the edges of this paper to make it look really old, even though it had blue lines on it. And then I folded it up and put it in, like, stuffed it in this wood pile that we had next to our house. And I ran up to this neighbor kid's house. And I said, "Hey, Nathan, we've got a, I think I found something down here. Come check it out." So I bring this kid down, like I force him against his will. He's like a year or two younger than me. He comes down. And I'm like, "Look in there, look in behind this wood. I think I found an old treasure map." And so he pulls it out. And it, like, I'm fairly certain this kid's not buying it at all. And, like, he's little. He was like younger than me, but he's still like skeptical, probably because of the blue lines on the paper. But anyway, he pulls it out, and I force him to follow the clues through this little treasure map. And we dig up this like old tin box that I buried in the yard, and with like some, you know, like some very modern coins in it, still, like quarters from 1978 or something ridiculous. And his mind was definitely not blown at all. I think he knew exactly what was going on. But the point of it is that that's when my storytelling really began. Like, I, with that little treasure map, my interest in that just grew and grew. And through the years, I was really interested in telling, you know, even though that's not a book, it was still a story of sorts.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's what got me started. And then in high school, I really started writing down ideas, and I wrote some short stories for assignments and stuff. And I feel like, you know, I tell people, when your heart starts racing and you're talking faster than you can think, that's probably whatever you're talking about or whatever you're doing is probably what you're supposed to do. And that's how it was with me with writing stories. Like, I couldn't tell stories fast enough, and I couldn't tell enough of them. And so I think probably around ninth grade was when it first started kind of hitting me that, man, I need to, like, I really like this. I did get in trouble with my freshman English teacher. That poor woman, and we're friends to this day. But she was in, you know, her 20s, and it was her first teaching job. And I'm here at this little Christian school with like 300 students, and she tells us to write this short story. And I write this very bloody scene that takes place. It's like this massive action sequence with a lot of violence. And she called me in after class that, or after school that day. She said, "I need to see you after school." I think she thought I was going to go nuts and hurt a bunch of people. And really, it was just what I was interested in. Like, you know, you're a ninth grade boy, you're into like violent movies and video right. games and whatever. And so it was nothing, you know, it was fine. But she ended up being very encouraging later on in my life story. And she and several other teachers and professors there were key moments where I spoke with them that they pushed me on. And in fact, there was a key moment, I think I talked about it on the SPF podcast, where I was at a funeral for a friend's mother, and she was one of my professors. And I bumped into that freshman teacher and my senior high school English teacher and two professors from college, and they all asked, just on their own accord, randomly, in different points in time that day, "Are you still writing? You were really good." And I'm like, "No, I actually was an English major, and I switched to psychology with basically a minor in history." And, "Oh, well, that's a shame. You were really good at it." And I'm like, maybe these people are onto something. Maybe I should go ahead and push forward with this. So, yeah, That's when it started. To answer your question, I can't give a short answer. It was probably around ninth grade, but I really started back into it around 2007, 2008, pushing ahead with full length stories.
Excellent. It's neat that you have those people that are there that you can look back on and say, yeah, with a little bit of push, they helped make it happen. And that's cool stuff, because I'm glad that they did that, because I'm glad I've discovered your Sean Wyatt series, because it's that treasure, that whole idea of treasure is a neat sort of thing. Especially, yeah. I know that's a great word, but
yeah. Well, I would say that, teachers, be very aware of what you say to kids. I had a lot of encouragement, but I had one professor. I changed my major from English to psychology as a direct result of one professor's comments. I took her a poem that I wrote, and she had already been real critical of some other stuff I wrote and not very helpful. And, she said, she finished reading it and she looked up and she said, "It's very trite." And I said, "Trite?" And she said, "Yes, it's very trite." And I said, "Thank you. Any suggestions?" She's like, "I don't know, throw it away," or something like that. She didn't say that, but that was the look she gave me. And I left the building and I went straight to the administration building and changed my major that morning.
Wow.
And it's years later, I bumped into, it's so crazy what a small world we live in, but I bumped into another writer who writes, I think she writes urban fantasy. And I didn't realize it, but she and I were at Southern at the same time. We were in the same classes. We were in the same graduating class. And she's like a best-selling author now. And she had the exact same experience with that professor, though. We both share this experience, and we were chatting about it a couple weeks ago when we realized that we weren't in the same world all this time. And teachers have to be cautious about that, what they say and how they say it, because I know that teachers walk on enough eggshells, but you never know how you're going to influence a kid's life. So it's really important how you word things. So that wasn't a question. That was just me throwing that out there. But
no, I'm glad you did. That's an awesome story to remind us about those, because a lot of times we think about only the, we like to think that we only encourage and so forth, but sometimes you say just the wrong thing at the right. I don't know if it's the wrong thing at the wrong time or the wrong thing at the right time, and it makes a huge difference in somebody's world, and they just take it to heart. And that's what you did there. And that's, it is so important. Well, that really kind of leads me into wanting to talk about the obstacles that you discovered in your writing and getting, trying to become a writer as you progress into writing. And then trying to get published. If you could just kind of talk a little bit about that.
Man, you are really smooth with these segues. I wish I could be so smooth in my conversations with people. So, the obstacles, it was early 2010, I think, when I'd finally finished my first manuscript for The Secret of the Stones. And there was a website, I can't remember the name of it now because it's been 8 years ago, but there's a website where you could put your stuff up there. It wasn't Wattpad, it was something else. And you could, they had a way for new writers to connect with agents. And there's this veil, right, that's between an author, a would-be author, and agents. And between the agent and the publisher is another veil. And you can't get straight to the publisher because of the gatekeepers that are in place. And it's hard to get to the agents because you have to buy some $50 book to find the author market. There's this blockade, right? It's hard to find agents. And then it's hard to query them. There's this whole format that they expect. And so I ended up submitting to 17 agents, I think it was, and I got rejected by all of them. They were all not interested in the story. And I looked at the Ben Mezrich story. He's the one that wrote the book about the MIT blackjack team and became the movie 21 and all that. Ben Mezrich had like 197 rejections all on his basement apartment wall in Boston. And he was maxed out on credit cards, and he was like, there was like no hope basically. But he kept writing, and he finally got the deal for that book, the Blackjack book. And I said to myself, I do not want to go through that. Like 197. First of all, I'd have to write like 180 more queries. I don't want to do that. I'd have to find like all those agents. I don't want to do that. And I didn't want to like, you know, I just didn't want to have to go through. I'm not that patient. And so I found a vanity press that does, you know, helps you self-publish your books. They did the cover. They did all that stuff. And they, you know, provide quote unquote services to help. And so that's what I did. It cost a couple $1,000s, and it was a huge waste of money. The book cover wasn't great. The editing was terrible. I sold like 50 copies that year. And it was just a huge, turn off to me. I didn't want to go through it again. And those obstacles were really, they're really tough for people. And before I really sat down and figured out, you know, thanks to a teacher I worked with telling me that she basically threatened me, saying, you know, you better write the sequel to that first book. I wouldn't have sought publishing in the way that I did and the way that I currently do it. And so, yeah, those obstacles are very tough. Getting something published in a traditional format is extremely difficult. And, it's also insane. Like, say these words out loud. There is a group of people in New York City who get to decide what the world reads. And they have no college training specific to that job. They have nothing other than experience that they learned from the people before them in that job, who also didn't have an, you know, specific education from college to that. And these people, this small collection of people, gets to determine what everyone in the world reads. That is insane. And that is the traditional publishing market. Like, that's how it works. Like, there's like five big publishers. Really three, but there's five big publishers, and those groups of people in a boardroom are brazen enough to believe that they get to decide what the entire world gets to read. That to me is insane. And I know that there's lots of little publishers and stuff like that, but essentially the big ones are the ones that make that call. That's the obstacle staring a writer in the face when you break it down. And it's a little insane to me. So, yeah, that's one of the biggest obstacles. Then the other one is finding readers. The marketing knowledge for authors, you know, 8, 9, 10 years ago wasn't out there. You could Google how to find more readers, and there was no answers. And so, those were really, really big problems, those two problems. But thankfully, Amazon came out with Kindle around, you know, 2009, 2010, somewhere in there. They changed the game for self-publishers and independent authors. Mark Dawson changed the game as far as, and Nick Stevenson did too. Those two guys were hugely influential in how I market my books. So, you know, marketing is a dirty word in some circles, but essentially you're just finding new readers. And it's not a dirty word, because you're giving people something that they want. And those guys taught me how to find more readers and how to get discovered by people who love to read the stuff that I write. And so, yeah, those were the obstacles. And fortunately, there were answers to get around them. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that. And I know what you mean there. And it's amazing to hear the number of rejections that some people have gotten, and then to inspire themselves, they kind of post them around, surround themselves with them.
Yes.
As opposed to the ones who then take that advice and just don't ever try to put anything forward after, they give up after a while, and which is sad, because you never know, that might be that next big thing right there that just got stuck in the drawer or in that electronic file.
Right. And you know, it's funny too. I mean, I know that they can't publish everything, but I can't imagine how much money they've lost on independent authors in the last 8 or 9 years that they turned down, that ended up selling millions of copies. I mean, the amount of money they've left on the table, they could have solved that issue. They could have hired more people to sift through their slush piles. They could have brought in more, you know, readers to, you know, examine stories, and they could do more, focus groups and things like that. They won't. They're stuck in an old system that doesn't work anymore. Independent authors, we have at least half of the market now, and maybe 60% of it, from what I've heard. And, you know, they still have a lot of power. They have a lot of money and influence and stuff like that, that the authors they do still have, they can push them really high. But I mean, it's an antiquated system that doesn't pay authors fairly. And I mean, I don't know about Steve Barry, but I talked to another author that, is a pretty well-known author, and they have to sell their books for $10, their digital books for $10, to make what I make on a $3 book.
Wow.
That's crazy. Like so where's all that money going? They have to do all their own marketing, you know, still. So, where's all that money go? It goes to the publisher. Well, the publisher's not the one that owns the intellectual property and created everything. So, anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. That's the risk you take when you interview me.
Always good. It's a good risk, because that's great information that you got there. Because you're so right, and I could just, you know, that outdate, because it's all been changed by the ability, and even those vanity publishing publishers, that industry's kind of changed a lot too, because of the ability to find alternative ways of publishing your work, and which has been awesome, that don't necessarily cost that arm and a leg or whatever, and you still should have had somebody else read it. Good stuff. I greatly appreciate you sharing that. So what I want to do is let's start getting closer to your thrillers now, because one of the things that I think is so cool about your writing is that you use real places. You're from Chattanooga, and you've been in North Georgia, you've been around Georgia, and in the first Sean Wyatt thriller, there are very recognizable places in Georgia. What made you decide to do this sort of technique in your writing?
Two things. So one great piece of advice that I got from some author, and I don't remember who it was, they said, write what you know. So that's, you know, I love history. I took, my friends were blown away. Like, why was I electively taking extra history classes in college? I took 2 semesters of U.S. history, and they're like, why? You only need one. I'm like, because I love it. This is amazing. You guys don't enjoy this? No, it's boring. Okay.
Sorry, I got to say this. As someone who has a couple degrees in history and who loves history, God, you know, that comment that someone, why, you only got to take one class. What are you taking two? Sorry, I think that's
I mean, I'm diverting from the question, and I'm keeping it here in front of me so I stay on track. But, you know, when I go somewhere historical, and I don't believe in ghosts, but I can feel the ghosts of the past, of those people that walked on this dirt before me. So when I go to Charleston, South Carolina, or Boston, Massachusetts, or Washington, D.C., you know, I feel like George Washington stood here. Paul Revere rode his horse through over there. You know, Samuel Adams is buried right here. You go to Charleston, you know, like you get the same feeling, you know, you go to those places on the Carolina coasts where the pirates were, you know, and like, all that stuff is just like all these things you read about. This is where they were. And you're like, it's almost, and I haven't been to Jerusalem yet. I haven't been to the Holy Land, and I've written some books about that stuff. And I had to go through a lot of like research to get those things correct and talk to a lot of people, but that'll bring me back to your question. But, when I go to those places, I feel like I'm in holy ground. You know, like I feel like it is, it, you're touching the past. And the only thing that separates you from Abraham Lincoln is minutes and seconds and hours, right? Like that's the only thing, that the place is still there where they were. It's just those, the time that has passed. And so the reason that I wrote, to start with, you know, your question about, writing in Chattanooga and Georgia, and I still continue to do that. I still feature Atlanta a lot and, Chattanooga now and then, which where I'm born and raised in Chattanooga, still live here. But Write What You Know is, it fits into that because I know these areas very well. And I know a lot about the local history. I know a lot of the unknown history that comes from, you know, local lore and legends that are passed down orally through time, like from my grandparents or from a friend's grandparent. And I feature some of that stuff in those early stories, the local legends that you won't find in books, things that my dad told me that about, you know, walking into the chief van house and two Native Americans walked in there one day and they walked past the park ranger and went to the fireplace and pulled a couple of gold bricks out of the fireplace. And they're like, what's going on here? You know, and then these two guys disappear. And like that happened, but it's not, you're not going to find it in a history book anywhere. And so these, like, all this stuff like that I know about from the local and the regional scene makes it very easy to write about. And so, especially when you're just starting out, it's really important to write what you know. And I've chosen to keep the headquarters for Sean and Tommy's agency in Atlanta. And now Emily's agency is there too, because I know Atlanta. Like, I've been going to Atlanta twice a month my whole life, you know, from childhood up for Braves games, Falcons games, whatever. And so I know the city, I know the layout, I know the culture. And same with Chattanooga and this whole region, really. So, that's why I chose to start things this way. And that's why the hub is there. So
I love it.
Cause I answered that question plus two others that you didn't ask.
I love it. I got two for the price of one, man. It's great stuff because it really, knowing those areas, it sucks you in and you get a feel for, you know, of being there and things like that. And I love it. So it's good stuff. And what I want to do now is I want to pop into, so let's use this now for you to tell everyone a little bit about Sean and his friends.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw that one. That was one I was afraid of on the list of questions. So Sean Wyatt essentially is me. And
nice. I was going to ask you if he was you or not.
Yeah, it's a simple way to put it. So, and you know, that's a, and as a, when I was just starting out as a writer, that is an easy way to get over some fears and blocks that you might have about telling a story. You just base it around your own alter ego or whatever. And so, Sean and I have a lot of things in common. He's terrified of heights. People ask me how I write the description of a fear of heights so accurately. And I said, it's because I feel that, like, that's exactly how I feel when I, you know, am in a high place or, you know, something like that. And so, but yeah, the things that he enjoys in life are things that I enjoy. Now that he is different in that he's a former government agent for an extrajudicial agency, and he's a butt kicker, and I haven't been in a fight since like eighth grade. I got punched outside a bar once, but it was because I was trying to help a buddy and somebody sucker punched me, and I looked at him. It was, our band was playing and we were loading up at the end of the night, and I looked at the guy and I said, "What was that for?" And he goes, "Oh shoot, you're with the band, you're the singer." And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Nice. I'm so sorry, we love you guys." And I'm like, "It's cool." So even when I got in a fight, I didn't get in a fight. But Sean, you know, I do know how to fight. Like, I learned how to box when I was very young, and I never took any martial arts, but I'm fascinated by martial arts, and maybe one of these days I will do some martial arts training. But Sean is the more well-trained version of me. And so, yeah, that's, he loves history, and Tommy, his best friend, loves history. And so I imagined Tommy. I don't actually have a friend that's like him. So Tommy is sort of the history loving friend that I never had growing up, being in, you know, I was all into sports and still am. And I was into music and played in a band, and I had friends. I had a friend for everything except a friend for writing and a friend for history. And so Tommy is like that creation of a friend that is just super into historical stuff. And that's not fair. My best friend of like 36 years is into history, but he's a doctor. So he was more interested in that stuff than he was history. But so that's what those guys are. They're, one is like a sort of a blurred mirror of me, and then the other, his sidekick, is the friend that, you know, that loves archaeology and history and stuff like that, that I didn't really have growing up. And so he's like, Tommy's like my personal Indiana Jones, that I get to play with, you know, two or three times a year. So
excellent. I love it. It's, well, they're exciting characters, and they, and that's neat that, that Sean is you. Cause that I could see that, being able to write, that device, you know, the idea of being able to write what you know and throwing it into your character. Good stuff. So now, you know, one of the things that, your stories are, is they're thrillers. They make you want to keep reading. And, you know, it's when you realize that it's 2 a.m, which I just did the other night, a couple nights ago, and you're like, oh crud, man, I gotta go to bed. That's a neat thing. What, you know, how did, I mean, why a thriller? Where is that? I mean, because yours are. I've read thrillers before where you're 50 pages in and you're going, okay, is there something thrilling going to happen at some point? No, you don't wait very long before you get our attention. So talk a little bit about that. This is the end of part one of my interview with Ernest Dempsey, the USA Today bestselling author of the thrilling Sean Wyatt series of books. Next week, the conclusion will pick up right where we left off. Remember, if you are listening to this during the week of May 14th, 2018, you can go to Amazon and get his first book, The Secret of the Stones, for free for your Kindle. If you missed that time frame, go to his website, ernestdempsey.net, and sign up for his email list, and you can also get his book that way. Thanks for listening. See you next week for the exciting conclusion. Ta-ta. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is excited to be a member of Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends.